Okay, so welcome back to LA Lit. Again, we're here with Guy Bennett. And we just want to open the floor really quickly to any audience questions that people have right now, and then we'll read some more work and then, you know, ask more questions. So please.
My name's Diane, and my question is that when I first became aware of you and your work, it was right after a futurist Italian Futurist Conference at UCLA.
Right.
And you're, in addition to being a musician and a poet and a teacher and a translator and all that, you also have an amazing talent for typography and design. And when you're talking about...
Well, first, just let me say thanks, because, you know, you're also coming from a type and design background, so that, you know. That's very nice.
But when you talk about the fortune cookies and the sort of finding the first L and then the second, you know, there's a definitely sort of a looking down, there's a visual component to the fortune cookie is embedded within, you know, in an almost visual way. And so I'm just curious to have you say a few things about your relationship, your work's relationship to the visual arts.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, gladly. Sometimes it's real related. I mean, in the case of the fortune cookies, I even before I sat down to do them or even had an idea of what they would be, I knew how I wanted them to look. And I, you know, I wanted it to start here and then that there be a tiny drop and that it continue on. And that this there be like a little first phrase that gets you going, and then you just keep moving. My idea was, I guess, to sort of make a little catch on the top that hopefully would make you wish to continue and go down, and sort of separate it in the manner of a title, but it's not really a title. It's just the first couple of steps into the poem. So each of the poems begin that way. Ridiculously, too, I even imagined that the title should be set in this typeface. You know, that in my mind, that's how I was thinking about it. It's totally meaningless, and what except perhaps to anybody but me. But so, in other words, I guess there was a kind of look to this thing that that started me going on these particular pieces. I don't know that I've ever really kind of worked. I mean, typographically per se, but I'm definitely sort of sensitive to it. Certain poems feel like they should be set in certain kind of typeface or whatnot, but that's ultimately the decision of whoever will publish them.
A little follow-up to that. Musical notation. I mean, have you worked mostly without that as a musician? Are you an improvisational
Both.
Art? So does that have any influence on...
On poems? Not really. Not really.
Okay,
I mean, yeah, I did the music, I studied composition for years, so I definitely did all of the, and even had to study medieval music and learn how to read those square notes and all of that sort of thing. But also worked in jazz groups, and so worked from, you know, the
charts.
Fake book and head charts, and and then worked in various rock and improvisational groups where there was no music. So it's sort of been in a lot of different areas, but if I'm not aware of any way in which it's kind of the notational aspect of it
has
come into here. Though, I mean, you know, I guess like a lot of people do, writing them, I mean, they're, and particularly the thing that I'll read next, there, you know, it's intended to be read the way that it's written with spaces where there are spaces and that sort of thing. You know, though I don't necessarily pause at the end of every line, I, you know, I'm definitely aware of the fact that, as, you know, people do, organizing their poems spatially, almost as a sort of score that is you quote-unquote perform as you read it, inserting spaces or perhaps making things louder or, you know, quieter depending on whether they're in caps or in italics or whatnot, that sort of thing.
Okay, thanks.
Well, you're welcome.
Kind of on the, oh, please, if we have another question, yeah, great.
Hi, David Lloyd. You talked about a lot of things, actually, I wanted to talk about before the break. But one of the things that I was interested in the conversation about was the question of process writing or procedural writing. And I'm curious, because I'm thinking, you know, of the traditional forms that just came up. meter, and, you know, pentameter or octosyllables and things like that, as well as forms like sonnets and villanelles and whatever. They're all forms that we're used to thinking of as available to anybody to pick up and use again, mm-hmm. and use differently and so forth. So my first question was really, do you think of the process writing that you do and that others do as something that is itself imitable, that someone else could pick up, say, like Stephanie was saying, can you pick up this mode of writing,
mm-hmm.
and then reproduce it in a completely different work for completely different effects? Or do you think of the process as absolutely particular to the poem that you're writing at any given time, so that almost like the process is exhausted by the single event that mm-hmm. it brings into being?
Oh God, I hope not, you know, but I don't know. I mean, first of all, I should say, I haven't really thought a lot about that question, but I definitely feel that, you know, these are just ideas that are out there. And I know that some of my things have been directly inspired by things other people have done and that I've wanted to steal from them. And one of the thing that comes to mind is a book by Joan Retallack called After Images, in which there's text that appears on the top of half of the page, and then underneath it, there are just little fragments of things, a couple letters, maybe a syllable, maybe an entire word. And it so happens that the little bits and pieces that appear on the bottom half of the page appear directly beneath where they appeared up on the top of the page. And in fact, they are bits and pieces of the poem on the top that quote-unquote sort of fell down to the bottom of the page. So she explains in a little note what an after image is. You know, you look at something long enough and it's kind of imprinted into your retina, and when you look away at something else, you see an image of this thing that remains, and that's the way she sort of conceived of these pieces. And that got me started in working on a manuscript that no publisher has yet had the fortitude to publish as a book, though all the poems have appeared in magazines. And there are a series of poems from which an after image appears on the following page, and was written using a constraint I had used in my first book of poems that came out the year before in 1998, which was like looking at other people's poems and then using as my source material the words that fell at the end of the lines of their poems, the quote-unquote last words of their lines. The book is called Last Words. And so I kind of combined those two things and pulled the last words of my own poems and used them in kind of an afterimage way on the other way. So, I mean, this is a way in which a sort of an appropriation of her thing to create something on my part. Perhaps if anyone was so moved, they could do the same thing here. I don't necessarily feel I've exhausted any of this in any way. I mean, with the McClough thing, there's also his method that I'm just borrowing for my purposes, and as I imagine many, many others have, and probably many others will do so. And I'd like to say, too, I look at this as being related to those fixed forms, this kind of writing. I was recently having a dialogue with a Moroccan poet named Hassan El-Wazani, who is a young poet. He's in his 30s, and he does interviews. He interviews poets for a Quebecois magazine. And in an interview, we were talking about this. I had sent him some work. And I think he kind of had a condescending look at the notion of process and constraints and all of that, he asked me, did I feel that this kind of language play was really serious, you know? And he maybe even put language play in quotation marks. So there was something that seemed slightly condescending about it. And my feeling was it's a part of the Western poetry is all about constraints, and it always has been, whether it's metrical constraints or phonetic constraints or formal constraints or whatnot. And we can look at anything going back to, you know, odes, and we're already seeing the germs of the fortune cookie and other such, you know, things. They're all a part of the same family, it seems to me. And one of the things that's interesting to me about poetry, and I think really it's the capital issue, and we talked a little bit about this last week when we all were here, it's the form issue is, for me, the primary issue of the poem. And I really feel that even for the poets that don't think about it, for whom it is not a quote-unquote issue, the minute you break that first line, you're consciously shaping your poem, and the form begins, it seems to me, at the end of that first line. And it's the capital issue with which you're going to deal consciously or unconsciously, purposefully or not purposefully. And I think all of these sorts of fixed forms and constraints and so forth are an animation or an end product of that sort of formal work.
If I can follow up on that. The thing that's bugging me, though, is thinking about these forms, which, you know, I've used in my time myself, that metric and the sonnet form, just to stick with that example, have the effect of aiding memory, and that one of the things they do is try to inscribe the poem in your memory. One of the things I find with processual work, which is not a bad thing, not a negative thing, is a completely different relationship to the notion of time.
Yes.
And to the retention of the words in your head.
Definitely true.
I'm wondering how you think about that, and how you think about, you know, as you read, to an audience, it's very difficult actually to retain what you've said, because part of the process is to sweep you on and not allow the repetition to actually engrave it, so to speak.
Right.
So I'm curious how you think about that in your practice and in terms of what you want to achieve.
Well, I'm definitely aware of the memory aid aspect of traditional metrical rhymed verse, and I think that that's fascinating. I as a kid really enjoyed learning poems and reciting them, and there were times as a teenager when I couldn't afford books, and I'd go to in those days the B. Dalton bookstore and copy the poems out, and helping to memorize them by writing them out. And even, you know, I have a daughter now who's 5 years old, but when she was an infant and we would go, my wife would read her stories at night, and when I'd get in there, I'd recite my Lewis Carroll poems to her. I was probably traumatized, but, she's been hearing Jabberwocky and so forth since she was that big. But all of that is something that I'm definitely close to and have a strong feeling for. This writing, I would agree with you. It seems to not have anything to do with, and maybe even contravenes to a certain extent, our sort of the memorization process of poems. But I have to say, too, that I might be able to recite one or two of those Barrett pieces from memory, maybe. It's never been an issue for me. Although I can recite other people's poems, I couldn't recite one of my own from memory, with the exception maybe of one of those first pieces I read. Doesn't worry me a whole lot, because I haven't yet been any place where they're saying, "Hey, guy, remember that one Barrett piece? Could you recite that to me?" I agree with your comment. That seems to definitely sort of bypass that part of the brain that wants to seek and retain based on patterns and repetitions and things. I don't know if I've answered your question, but
well, I don't want to hog the mic, but just because I'm really curious, though, about what that means about meaning and what that means about what the function of the poem becomes if we write in a way that is about a constant erasure of what has gone before. I mean, the same question is about new music, which is also notoriously difficult to retain in the memory once it's passed.
Right.
So that's really what I'm thinking about, rather than whether one can recite it.
Yeah, I'll have to think about that, since there's a really interesting question. I haven't really given it a lot of thought, to be honest with you, the effect of that type of procedural writing.
Something that, like, Stephanie and I were talking about just in dialogue after we kind of read some of the work is that... it's like we're talking about the Lilac Variations. Well, what I don't remember what was in that poem, and yet, you do have a memory of something that it evoked, of a sense of something, and yet I couldn't go back and recite a line or say, oh yeah, it was saying this, or I think that's an effect anyway, which is interesting, and kind of along the same lines. Before we recorded this interview, we were talking with you and talking about this kind of the isms and the whatever of the 20th century, all these different movements, and talking about how, in a way, a kind of a modernism was like, as you said, the railroad track is laid down and this is where we're going. And then things came in to break that up. And now it's like there is no railroad track, and I don't even know what the wheels are made out of.
Right.
And you get kind of to that point, and it's... And I this isn't, and also, like you said, this isn't necessarily something that we can sit back and say, this is good, this is bad, but yet you have to take it in and realize that this is where we're operating.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, there is something about this process writing, these types of process writings where a sonnet announces to you, the process. You can't read it and not be like, and not notice that something's going on.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the process writing, you know, yours and other types, it's oftentimes within the writing there's comments about the process, and that's almost where you pick it up just in reading it. You sometimes don't even pick it up because you notice the process, because oftentimes these processes are so idiosyncratic and kind of like really, I don't know, odd processes that, yeah, so I'm going off here, but... But oftentimes that type of process writing, it's like, you know, Ulipo, their types of process, they always say that you know, the piece should comment on the process in some oblique manner. So, you know, oblique strategies or whatever, but I don't know what you think about that. But
well, I mean, there comes back to your comment, and there, it's a very interesting issue. I have some friends who are very big music lovers, you know, go regularly to concerts now at Disney Hall, but for years at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. They're very knowledgeable classical music. They're musicians themselves, and we were having a discussion at one point about Webern, and they definitely just didn't have a feeling for him and had a lot of problems with his work, though they are very, you know, very open-minded with respect to, you know, contemporary painting and so forth. Had a big problem with the music, and we had a discussion, and at one point, one of them said to me, "That's just like, after I listen to it, I can't hum. I can't hum anything that happened in it. There's no melody that I can remember or recognize, and it just..." And that constituted something that was very off-putting to her. And I understand that to a certain extent. But I sort of feel that, you know, we've grown up with that other hummable stuff. And all of the, whether we were aware of it or not, we have interiorized all the rules and regulations that allows it to be hummable. Mm-hmm. And we are masters at those rules. From, you know, hearing the ice cream man pass with his jingling bell, listening to Beatles on the radio or anything else, where it's constantly being reinforced. And when we get this alternative system, it can be off-putting. And so I understood her comment. For me, the key thought is it is an alternative system. There's not only one possible. There are many different ones. That's one of them, and these other ways are other ways. And her comment also was interesting to me because it posed the issue that memorizability, so to speak, was desirable and necessary, in her case, for enjoyment. And that's very interesting in and of itself. I don't necessarily feel that's the case. I love Webern's music, though I couldn't hum it. Yet I also enjoy the ability to be able to recall and reproduce from memory. I just sort of see it as a different way of going about it. And that's certainly not anything that I'm trying to achieve in what I'm doing. Though, you know, that could be seen as a big shortcoming. It's just an issue that I haven't really kind of grappled with because it's never really struck my mind. I'm kind of just enjoying both, you know.
I think it comes too up in issues of being on the page and textual versus an oral culture, which has sort of been channeled into a different arena in our society, like in hip hop and rap, with kids standing outside in groups of five or six rapping together, just improvising. I mean, that's a strong oral tradition that goes back in English and other languages, and then in poetry, there's still that in poetry too, of course, but the poetry now is very much on the page, and so I think that makes a difference too.
And on the screen increasingly, you know.
Yeah, on the computer screen, yeah, that's true. More and more. You don't even have to print it out anymore.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should jump to reading the sequences piece, which is funny because this is the one piece that you say where you're trying to break away from this seriality and
a little bit.
So I don't know if you want to say anything about that piece in particular.
Or? Well, just quickly to say that it was another kind of commission thing. A small chapbook press publisher asked me to write a text on medieval music. About which I have nothing to say. And though I enjoy it, I've played it, I admire it, and so forth. And so, as we were saying earlier today, you know, the idea was to take a look at medieval music to see what it could give me in terms of, once again, a way into writing a piece. And I looked at the sequence, which was sort of the second movement, so to speak, of the medieval mass, and I tried to adapt the structural qualities of the text that were used in the sequence for the bulk of this poem. So the sequence is kind of a gloomy part of the Mass. Not that the Mass is always overjoyful or what have you, but it's a particularly gloomy part. And the poem kind of unconsciously and unintentionally turned out to be a bit gloomy. I'd just like to say too that this, it was written at some point just after the torture photos from Abu Ghraib became known, and it comments a little bit on those. So it's called Sequences. And there's a little epigraph from William Caxton's Golden Legend, which reads, "During that time, men say no sequence, for the sequence signifieth joy and consolation." And on about the need to change my topos, coal gleaming in fish crinkled, blue snaps a tropery, this book of sequens, victime, pascali, veni, sancte. Spiritus left the body, raced for sky, mind all tangled and formal. Schemes flashing pink plastic wrap, daisies, fact of following after her. Succeeding laudacion, deus ire, stabat mater, shots squeezed off at unarmed. Insurgents, it's no longer happening in poetry, rain, pearl, tail fin, brake light. Red pursuance in or consequence of Columba aspectsit ave generosa ignus. Then came a long sequence of reflections. One in which a smiling female soldier gives the thumbs up before the battered face of a dead prisoner. And one in which a smiling male soldier gives the thumbs up with one hand and we're number one with the other before the battered face of a dead prisoner. And one in which a prisoner, hooded and cloaked, stands arms akimbo, wired to conduits climbing the wall. And one in which a prisoner, hooded and cloaked, has collapsed over the railing he's cuffed to. And one in which a prisoner is cuffed to a bed, a pair of panties covering his face. And one in which a naked prisoner, smeared with shit, stands arms akimbo before a club-wielding soldier. And one in which a squatting prisoner in an orange jumpsuit cowers before a large dog restrained by a soldier. And one in which a naked prisoner stands back to cell, bars, knees, clasped hands behind head before three soldiers restraining two large dogs. And one in which a naked and wounded prisoner lays bleeding on the ground, mouth open and scream, while a soldier stands over him gripping his arm. And one in which a prisoner in red shorts balances precariously on boxes bent over hands between legs, chained to cell door, black hood on his head. And one in which a woman soldier stands next to a naked prisoner lying on the ground at the end of a leash. And one in which a grinning woman soldier gives the thumbs up with one hand and points at the genitals of a naked, hooded prisoner with the other. And one in which the same grinning woman soldier gives the thumbs up with one hand and points at the genitals of another naked, hooded prisoner with the other. And one in which two soldiers, a man and woman, stand grinning behind a group of naked prisoners lying piled on the ground. And one in which two soldiers, a man and woman, stand grinning and giving the thumbs up behind a group of naked prisoners lying piled on the ground. And one in which naked hooded prisoners appear to be masturbating. And one in which naked hooded prisoners appear to be fucking. And spiritus targeted civilians leaving the vehicle of my introspection a constellated. Text, charcoal rich clouds slide by on wires, a continuous connected series of things, liber scriptus proferetur in quo, should I hit him, shit, missed the fucker arranged mosaic-like in tight patterns, black man in, white man in. Black quality of being sequent, fact of following per sepulchra regionum cogit. Omnis, burqa pulled over the head, bent her over or loosened it up, i.e. randomized the process seated feeble seniors, fondles revolver, successive parts of an argument quid sum misertunc dictura screwed her on the desert. Floor not predeterminate, everything outright cop car stop that raised dust. Yard, continuity, consecutiveness, and so on. Mors stupebit et natura cum resurgit. Creatura, stoop down, blade to throat, jerk, not refine, overdo, overdetermine. Overbalding businessman sits blank on bed, one thing after another, an instance of this quid quid latet aperibit nil in ultim, ramanebit fires on crowd and street awe. Dude, shake it up, intuit, go for feel, free, rhythm, her quote, mean, pinched, bitter, evil. face logical consequence, also inference, conclusion, in jamisco, tanquam reus. There are fixed in his associative memory certain sequences as always occurring. I would not say that the future is necessarily less predictable than the past. I think the past was not predictable when it started. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know that there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. There's another way to phrase that, and that is that the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. It's basically saying the same thing in a different way, simply because you do not have evidence that something does not exist. Excuse me, that something does exist does not mean you have evidence that it doesn't exist. I believe what I said. I don't know what I said. I know what I said, but I think what I said, and, well, I assume it's what I said. And if I said yes, that would then suggest that that might be the only place where it might be done, which would not be accurate, necessarily accurate. It might also not be inaccurate, but I'm disinclined to mislead anyone. Something's neither good nor bad, but thinking makes it so. I suppose, as Shakespeare said, if I know the answer, I'll tell you the answer. If I don't, I'll just respond cleverly. I would not say I think we know, we know, we know. We also know, we know. We do not know, we don't know, we don't know. I believe I said, I don't know, I said, I know, I think, I assume I said, I said. I'm disinclined, I suppose. I know, I'll tell you. I don't, I'll just respond. The future past, the past unknowns, things unknowns, things unknowns, ones, the absence, evidence, evidence, absence, same thing, evidence, something, evidence, place, thinking, answer, the answer. Culpa, shadow figure, vaporized next to tractor, the whole fitting loosely, but fitting child, frightened stands, stiff in field, this following of one thing after. Another, dic nobis Maria, quid vidisti in via, second figure crawls from under. Tractor, each part discreet, but suggesting unity, fera wannabe, in ecstasy, astride fire. Hydrant, multiple shots engaging a single theme, mors, evita, duello, conflixere. Mirando, vaporized in turn, burned, smoked, snuffed, seek content elsewhere, engage, go on.
You mentioned that this work is a bit of a departure from the sequence.
Yeah.
Although it's entitled Sequences. How is that so?
Well, I mean, the others were all plotted and planned. There was a procedure, there was a method, there was a constraint, there was something that I used to, ahead of time, predetermine how the text would be written. And the text was the result of putting that process into movement. And I just sort of coming at the end of a period of sort of serial texts and whatnot, such as the Barrett pieces and then the Whitman variations. And I just felt that was becoming too much of a comfortable thing to do. I was familiar with it. I was able to kind of do it on command, as it were, and felt that I wanted to try to put that aside and work on slightly looser forms that would not be so heavily determined and preordained or organized ahead of time, and allow a certain kind of suppleness and looseness and give me some fluidity, so where if I felt in the middle of the piece that it needed to go somewhere that it wasn't intended to go at the beginning, I could still go there, and that it was flexible enough to permit that. So this piece for me is very unusual. It kind of signifies a slight changing of direction with where I'm currently going. And that's a part of wanting to sort of put aside the more programmatic and serialized things and explore other possibilities. So.
Yeah, I mean, you even, what I find interesting in this piece also is that you kind of, similarly to what we were talking about, when you do pick up forms, you kind of comment about the form, mm-hmm. even in the writing, and you kind of do it even in this piece. You say, you know, arranged mosaic-like, you know, in tight patterns. Maybe that's commenting on previous ones. You said, not refine, overdue, overdetermine is another line in there. And, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know. At some point you're just like, dude, shake it up, man. You know,
yeah.
See what happens. You know?
Yeah, basically.
But, so, I mean, I find that interesting. And yet, I feel like, and we can talk more about how you put this together, but even putting the Latin lines in there, I think you had said, Well, talk about where you got those.
Those are the titles of existing sequences that we have from the medieval mass. So they're either the titles or sometimes the first line when there was no title. There are only five or six apparent sequences that have survived and that we know about. So those lines are quoted in there. In a sense, this piece is one of the things that it's about is its own sort of coming into being. It's a kind of a commenting on where, you know, where I am now and what I need to do to get somewhere else. That works its way into there as well. So, the lines that you pointed out, certainly they're just me writing about what I'm trying to do or what I'm seeing I can do with this and so forth.
Yeah. So. Well, and then it also seems like in here it's almost like you pick up for maybe a page or two or maybe three pages, like a little kind of micro kind of form, you know, that slightly influences something for a bit, and then you move on to something else. I mean, you can, and I can, you know, it's like the part where you're, I know.
Yeah.
And that big chunk, and then it seems like, you know, the next page is like everything that started from the previous page with I, and the page after that is pretty much everything that was left in the paragraph.
Right, right. That was, those were those various Rumsfeldisms that are just, they would be funny if they didn't come from him in this context. And, you know, once again, this sort of thing was just in the air, and there comes a time where I don't necessarily consider myself to be much of a social commentator in my writing, that this creeps in, and it's difficult to not let it be there, you know. And I guess, you know, those were just a string, literally word for word quotations from him, all of that outlandish stuff. And sure enough, as you said, the second two variations on it are just reduction, kind of as if to say, you know, you can just reduce this down to nothing because that's pretty much what it is.
Well, it's amazing how close, you know, Rumsfeld gets to Beckett. kind of like little turns like that he's doing there. I didn't realize that was Rumsfeld. I should have. But
yeah, all of those things are things to, you know, you know it all. You know, terrible, terrible.
It's interesting that, I have a friend who's taking a epistemology class, and we've been talking about the skeptical challenge, which is that you can't know anything. This could all be a dream. So when I read that part, I was like, oh, you know, there it is, skeptical challenge. I don't know what I know.
Yeah.
Because I can't know anything. Here it's juxtaposed with Latin from the Mass that the Catholic Church eventually had to get rid of because nobody could understand Latin anymore. And then again, juxtaposed with what's going on mm-hmm. with the prisoners and
mm-hmm.
what can we know, and then there's these pictures and it's all kind of playing off each other in this.
Well, that's another interesting thing about it. I mean, not necessarily about this poem, but about this process and how it results in things and what I learned from it afterwards. As I said earlier, I really don't start out with something that I'm intending to write about, but you inevitably write about something, and in the end you saw what you wrote about. I mean, there's a wonderful line by Marguerite Duras who said, writing is an attempt to find out what you'd write if you wrote. And as I was doing this, as I said, I didn't try to predetermine and overdetermine. I just kind of gathered a certain amount of material that I want to work with and allowed myself to kind of play with it. And after the fact, and I saw what it was quote unquote about, and that was very striking to me, that the a lot of it revolved around these representations of either the tortures, you know, prisoners being tortured, or commentary on some of those videos that were released on the internet at one point of people, you know, that were shot from the American helicopters that were firing on the Iraqi vehicles with Iraqi civilians in them. And you're hearing the audio commentary of the pilots as you're watching these people literally just be vaporized. And that a lot of it had to do with the representations of those things, and exactly as you said, like, what can we know about it? The known knowns, the known unknowns, and all this bullshit terminology that inevitably goes nowhere and says nothing. And the whole thing seems to somehow or other, plus the grimness of the sequence, and it just somehow, I mean, I wasn't consciously thinking about it, but I was surprised afterwards that I guess unconsciously there was something that I was, I don't know, trying to get at or was getting at me, and somehow or other got in there.
Yeah.
It just all seemed to revolve around, you know, mediations of the war, the images that we receive here, the commentary on those images, other commentaries on the war, and so forth and so on. And at the same time, once again, focusing on, you know, the poem itself and the act of writing it and so forth. So I'm not too sure that those things even go together. But anyway, that's sort of where that poem got to.
Well, I would say, like, you know, your representation of the torture photographs is probably is to me. I mean, you know, I don't know if this is a compliment, but maybe one of the more disturbing ways that I've quote seen it.
Uh-huh.
And you know, and it's a hard section to read through. And yet, what I find interesting in this piece is it's not like, you know, that representation, the way you are giving it to us, just kind of bare textual descriptions. You're not bracketing it with these commentaries, except for, and then a long sequence of visions or something occurred. And so it's just kind of giving it to us, and yet obviously it's still mediated in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even unmediation is, you know, of course, I'm not saying, you know, just represent the thing as it is, because we know that's kind of ridiculous, but what I find interesting is that you're not making, like, a statement, like, coming out and saying, this is what I think, mm-hmm. and yet, you know, through the whole piece, you know, again, it's like something is evoked, and it's more like, I don't know.
I was trying to keep that neutral in there, and something that you said is kind of interesting to me, the idea that you found them, it was a disturbing way to talk about those pictures. And I'm a fan of some of J.G. Ballard's work, which I find very creepy and disturbing. And as a matter of fact, I'm teaching this semester his Atrocity Exhibition, which, in spite of that frightening title, is not a graphic or violent work in an overt kind of way. But it's very uncomfortable to read. And so part of the interest for me is what is causing that discomfort? Why am I feeling so uncomfortable when I read his work? And I think a lot of it has to do with this kind of neutral, sort of clinical tone in which he's describing things which are potentially ominous or potentially harmful or violent, without the violence ever being described or drawn. I mean, these pictures are pretty horrible. We've all seen them, and it was an attempt to sort of, as you say, just want to put them there, and then people will think what they'll think about them and then move on. But I mean, even then, as you said, it's not possible to be neutral. I was consciously trying to be, but there's terms in there that obviously are very pointed, and they couldn't be any other way, you know?
Yeah.
Or I wasn't able to make them any other way. But yeah, I didn't want to make a sort of moral statement or whatnot. I think it's clear, you know, the right and wrong part of all of this.
Yeah.
So.
And kind of along this, I mean, you were talking about how you put this together in a kind of like a discovery of, you know, finding these pieces and putting it together. And I think about a title of Lynn Hagenian's collection of essays, A Language of Inquiry,
mm-hmm.
and thinking of, you know, the way she talks about, you know, it's not like you jump into writing. Again, this is something we've been talking about the whole time. It's not like you jump into writing a piece because you're going to say something and, like, you mm-hmm. quoted, you know, you write to find out what you would be writing about if you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like it is kind of diving in to, you know, see what's there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, kind of language of discovery, I guess. Anybody have any questions out there? Anybody, any other questions? I think Amar might. Yeah.
So yeah, I'm Amar. What struck me from what you were talking about, at least answering that question about something that's unmemorizable,
mm-hmm.
and how you like John Cage, I spent like a month listening to lectures on nothing in the morning, and I was thinking about it when you mentioned it, and I was like, I can't remember anything about that except apple pie. And
see, that I can remember some parts from, because some of them are so wonderful and memorable.
Mm-hmm. But then the other thing is like, well, that makes me want to go listen to it again.
Uh-huh.
So it immediately opens up that kind of writing to a sort of desire to re-experience it, because you can't quite, because it gets a little bit ethereal when it doesn't
mm-hmm.
have a refrain or something
mm-hmm.
like that to sort of anchor in your memory, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then in this piece, the one that you just read, you have a very sort of incantatory refrain.
Huh.
The one in which.
This is the first time I've ever read it, by the way, so I stumbled a bit here and there. I hope that wasn't too weird.
So, but I was wondering, like, how, you know, sort of quasi-religious introduction of those photos and, like, what kind of compelled you to do that, because that also makes a, I mean, you're trying to, the images are so ingrained in our minds, like, they're very overdetermined.
And we only saw the good ones. Apparently there are a lot of very frightening ones which were never shown to us.
So then I was
just, these were just okay.
So then I was wondering, like, how that, like, what your desire was in wanting to sort of incant that, so to speak.
I didn't really think about it in that way, and I understand the sort of, you know, the litany side of it with that repetition, and one in which. I guess this tells you a lot about me here, is like, I wasn't really thinking a lot about this. I wasn't really planning that I needed to have this tone or that I wanted to convey this kind of thing any more than what I described to you before reading the piece. So I wasn't really aware of that or didn't really think about it. In a way, it makes perfect sense given everything else about the poem, but it's interesting that, as I said, I've never really read this in public before, and I guess I'm still trying to figure out how I will negotiate that. But it's interesting that's what came across, that's what I did. I mean, maybe it's just in there or it was there in me when I was working on the poem.
Well, I mean, it's kind of, that's not, you know, in a sort of religious context or, like, you know, in terms of mass or something, you don't want to repeat maybe you do. I mean, when they talk about hell, they repeat the horrors of hell, right? So, I mean, that's what I was... That's what it kind of brought to mind, right? But then the other thing that was curious from the beginning of the discussion was this notion about the Romantics. Mm-hmm. And you said that you steal inspiration from other people, right?
Yeah,
or other texts.
Definitely.
Like, where the origin of their inspiration came from, also very, like, undetermined and celestial or whatever you want to say. So I thought that kind of positioned you as sort of anti-romantic, not necessarily in love with the Romantics, but you are. But so I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, I mean, there's the whole divine inspiration thing, you know, is, while a part of the Romantic project, is obviously something I don't particularly believe in. And I don't write that way, as everything I've been saying, I guess, demonstrates. I don't have any comment to make on it other than, you know, I guess each one works the way that they do because that's the way that they can. You know, with me, this is the most efficient way for me to do what I want to do or accomplish what I want to accomplish in writing a poem. I've done the other kind too, with waiting for those bouts of inspiration and then getting it down. But I'm generally not satisfied with what I come up with. And as I said earlier, I'm much more comfortable kind of working from a pre-existing text and taking that and somehow or other, like in translating, changing it somehow, transforming it somehow, and making a new thing that's based on it and related to it, but that's at the same time something different. So. Cool.
Okay. Go for it, Amar, if you have another question, please. No, okay.
Yeah, that totally answered my question. I mean, in the sense that, yeah, you don't believe in this divine inspiration concept, so it makes it totally apropos that you would use the Romantics as your source, in or like Whitman or anyone who might have that notion and subvert it in that way.
All right, I had never thought about it, but yeah, I could see that. It's kind of almost a sort of funny commentary just on that, the selection of source materials in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
We can look at the Romantics as utilizing sources. I mean, perhaps they attributed them to divine inspiration or to the cosmos or whatever. But, you know, just rereading some of this Whitman, he was strongly influenced by Emerson. And, you know, as he sings the song of himself, yet it is about everything he's seeing around him, too, as his source. His source of sound and his source of image and everything. So... I mean, perhaps they weren't as hyper-aware as we are about using all these things and stealing, in a way. But I think maybe we could say they still did.
And another comment is something I was thinking about. I mean, in a way, like Syd Barrett, we kind of put in this also romantic camp. But if we know the story of Syd Barrett too, it's kind of like, it's almost like he's suffering the romantic hallucinatory visions, you know, to a certain level of, you know.
In his case, obviously, they were much more sort of chemically
induced. Yeah, chemically induced. Yeah, a kind of chemical inspiration as opposed to divine, but. And yet, still, it's like similar hallucinatory kind of like whatever, and what it led to for him, you know, maybe not so good for him, you know. But anyway, well, any other questions from anybody? Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've really enjoyed.
Thank you guys
on the show.
All for coming out.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you for coming down, and hopefully, we'll see more of your work out and about in the world, you know.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That was great.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.